Welcome to Acamedia, presented by the Society for Cinema and Media Studies. I am Christine Becker.
And I am Michael Kackman. We are joining you from sunny South Bend, Indiana.
Technically cloudy and like 50 degrees, but yeah. It's still spring. It counts as spring.
Take every win.
Yep. And we are at nearly the end of our semester, so we hope you all are someplace tolerable in your semesters or quarters. It's been a semester, I guess is what I can say.
Yeah, it's been a time. I don't have anything wise to say. I've been, I kind of got in the habit in my classes this semester to like just begin class by asking them who had good news. Like, who's got something good to talk about? And, you know, it could be a job or, you know, just like watched a good episode of TV or something. And for a while I was telling myself that I was doing this because, you know, I felt like they needed it. But of course, it wasn't about them.
Yeah. No. Well, also so we have now a 2-semester history of television sequence, and you did part 2 this semester, and then a number of your students come right into my media industries class just after that. And I gotta say, you leave them a little depressed about the state of the world. So, and then they come into mine, and it's
we're not gonna make it better, kid.
No, and it's just difficult, and you know, deciding what do they need to know about? Because that's the other thing. It's, you know, I always try to stay in my lane and just teach what my topic is, but especially things that the Trump administration are doing are seeping into every single aspect of our lives, and so. So much of my class, and I start out the class with what I call news banter, inspired by KCRW's The Business podcast, which I give a shout out to. It's fantastic. And they start out with banter. And so we do that. Like the students bring in news stories and I bring in industry stories. And I did, by the end of the semester, I decided I have to end news banter now with a happy story or good news. Like, you know, the big one near the end was how well Sinners did at the box office and the idea that people are maybe going back to movie theaters. Because otherwise I was ending on whatever the latest nightmare was. And like, okay, now let's talk about distribution or whatever. It was a tough shift. So,
yeah, it's been a grisly semester for that kind of thing. And I'm sure we are not alone in that experience.
Yep. Well, now let's move to
our interview. What you got?
Here we go. So we have a really special event here. This is an interview of playwright and screenwriter Jose Rivera. And this is an interview conducted by Jordan Scholl, who has been on our podcast before. Mm-hmm. And also want to give a shout out to Jonathan Nichols-Pethick, who brought this to us. So we're extremely excited to have this interview. Great interview, great interviewee. And so we're super excited about this.
Yeah, this is a good one. And it's a really nice snapshot of, I really like hearing people talk about kind of the weird stuff in their career, like all the kind of goofy steps along the way that only in retrospect start to cohere as a career. And I think there's some of that here.
We should also note, as they do in the interview, this was recorded on January 21st. So politics comes up, but just keep in mind, this was recorded before we fully knew what all was going to happen in the next few months. Let me also give you a bio for Jose Rivera. He was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, but his family moved to New York City when he was 4. And then when he was 12, he saw a performance of the play Rumpelstiltskin, and the audience reaction to it inspired him to become a playwright. So his plays include Cloud Tectonic, Marisol, references to Salvador Dali, Make Me Hot, and Adoration of the Old Woman. He's won 2 Obie Awards for playwriting. He's also written for television, including Norman Lear's AKA Pablo, and he co-created the series Eerie Indiana. But he's most famous as a film writer, in particular for writing the screenplay for The Motorcycle Diaries, based on Che Guevara's memoir, that earned him an Oscar nomination in 2005. So here we go, Jordan Scholl interviewing Jose Rivera.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about how you fell in love with playwriting?
Yeah. I mean, I fell in love very early in life. I wanted to be an actor for a short time. But yeah, I was lucky to go to really good public school that had a theater and a black box theater and an orchestra, one of those well-stocked schools. So, I was exposed to a lot of really good work very young. and you know, performed in a lot of plays. But it was, you know, it was reading The Glass Menagerie that kind of like hooked me like a drug. And I said, I love this. I want to do this very thing. And started writing plays in high school, and that continued in college. And then I didn't go to graduate school after college, but went to New York and started kind of learned on the streets, as it were. And, you know, really sort of like, you know, just watched and hung out with older writers who were happy to sort of take in a young kid and teach him a few things. So that's really how it all began for me.
What did you find yourself gravitating towards in those early plays, the first ones that you wrote? What was the sort of thing that sparked your imagination in terms of your own content, what you wanted to write about?
Yeah, I think early on, you know, a lot of things just came from life experience. So one of my after school jobs was at this factory that employed young people who had Down syndrome, for instance, or had some kind of learning disabilities. And I was a volunteer. I went there and I would talk to the kids, help them with their projects and stuff like that. And I wrote a play about that. You know, and so almost everything that I had done early in life, especially, was really about just, in a way, recording dramatically, you know, what my life experience was at the time.
And over the course of your career, do you feel like that has changed? Do you still start from a very personal place, or do you often find yourself starting more an invention?
Yeah, I think it's now become a hybrid of the two. So virtually everything I do has a deeply personal component. So the play that we're reading tomorrow here at the school just started from, you know, an actual night that I spent watching an eclipse in Brooklyn with a bunch of people in a basketball court. So everything I do has that kind of personal inspiration, spark, origin. But then I do like to invent things. And, you know, there are two characters in this basketball court play that are from another dimension who come to our dimension through the portal created by the lunar eclipse. So obviously not real. But to me, that was the fun part. You know, that to me, that lifted the play from kind of, you know, just kitchen sink realism into something more theatrical and fun for me to write, and hopefully for an audience. You know, so yeah, things, you know, I've written autobiographical plays. I'm from Puerto Rico. I've written plays about Puerto Rican independence or my parents' immigrant experience, that kind of thing. You know, if it doesn't have a deeply felt core, I don't even attempt to write it.
So you had moved to New York, you were writing plays, you were, you know, meeting artists, and you started writing for the screen with television, is that right? How did you get into that?
Yeah, so in 1983, my very first play was produced in New York, called The House of Ramon Iglesias. It's about my family. And as just as dumb luck would have it, Norman Lear, the TV producer, was looking for a writer for a series he was developing about a Chicano family living in LA. And his executive had seen the play, got a good review in the New York Times, and suddenly, lo and behold, I was in the room with Norman Lear having a meeting. And he liked me, and I liked him, and he hired me on the spot to work on the series. And I said to Norman, I don't even own a television. I don't know anything. I'm not funny. I don't know why you want me for sitcom. I'm not Chicano. You know, there's so many reasons not to hire me, but I think he thought that was all very charming and funny and hired me.
I'm sure there are not many writers in a room with Norman Lear who would try and talk their way out of a job.
I know. I just like, let's be honest here. So I moved with my then wife from Brooklyn to LA, which was a culture shock. And, you know, unfortunately, I was the only Latino on the writing staff, which is a problem. And as I said to Norman, I said, look, the experience of Chicanos in LA is so foreign to me, being a Puerto Rican from New York. But he didn't seem to care or it didn't worry him. And the show was not a good show. To be honest, it was too big. It was a big family. Norman was experimenting, because usually sitcoms are three cameras. Mm-hmm. He had like nine. I mean, it was just a mess. And so we were canceled after the end of, I don't know, six episodes or something. It was on ABC. And, you know, they kept me on salary for a while. I ended up working on another sitcom, and I was miserable. And at the end of that experience, you know, I went back to New York. I said, hell with this. This is nuts. But then again, my ex and I had a child, and, like, suddenly we have a two-year-old and no money, so we went back to L.A. And I had an idea for a TV series, which can be summarized in two words. Maybe it's three. Teenage Twilight Zone was the idea. And I pitched that to my agents, and they said, that's brilliant. Oh, my God. And so, you know, it was just like a crazy experience. Like, I was paired up with a writer from ICM, which is my agency. And, you know, I had an idea, but I didn't have a deal. He had a deal, but no ideas. So I thought it would put us together. And, you know, we ended up selling it to NBC. And that became a series called Erie, Indiana, which was on the air for one season.
I've been watching Erie, Indiana. It's a delight. It's so fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah, we had fun doing it. And I had fun. And I was the co-creator and producer on that series. And I had a great time writing them and overseeing production and stuff like that. And I didn't know anything about production at all. And it was shot on 35 millimeter, just like an old-fashioned movie. We had Joe Dante directed the pilot in several episodes. It was a good, good production. And, you know, I had never been involved in a shoot, and I had never been involved in post-production. So all that was new to me. I was just learning every day, which was great. Unfortunately, we were at the bottom of the ratings barrel, and, you know, we were on the same time as 60 Minutes, which was the top-rated show of its time, and we were decimated in the ratings, and we would beg NBC to just change this time slot. Half hour sooner, half hour later, that would help, but they refused to do it. And the show was like the sacrificial lamb, and we died. And so I was deeply disillusioned mm-hmm. by that experience. And I said, never again am I doing television. I hate television. I hate television people. I hate the networks. And so I started writing screenplays. You know? So I went from one fire into another. And so, yeah, that's really how that all began.
And I know that you worked in film writing screenplays for a while before The Motorcycle Diaries, but how did, I'd love to hear just about Motorcycle Diaries, how that came about and sort of how that changed your career.
The short answer is I spent 14 years writing screenplays that never got made. So, I mean, I made a living. I put my kids through private school. I bought a house. We got out of our debt, and every year I would get another assignment. Oh, here's a screenplay for Michelle Pfeiffer. Here's a remake for Disney. Here's a rewrite for someone else. And I would take the assignments, and I would do my best, and then nothing would ever happen. And so for 14 years, I thought, well, that's screenwriting life. You know, you write things that are never seen. And then I get a call from my manager, and he says, oh, Walter Salles, the Brazilian director, is looking for a writer on this project based on The Motorcycle Diaries by Che Guevara. Are you interested? Do you want to meet Walter? And I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I hadn't read the book, so I didn't know anything about it. And I hadn't seen Central Station, which was the film he was nominated for Best Foreign Film. And so I quickly, got a copy of Central Station and watched it like the day before I met Walter, and I loved it. Oh, it's such a beautiful movie. It's such a gorgeous film. But I said to myself, wow, if Walter is nothing like this movie, I'm going to be so disappointed. And then, so we met in it wasn't the Beverly Hills Hotel, but it was a hotel in Beverly Hills. We met for lunch. And I had just had a an anthology of my plays published. So I brought one for Walter as a gift, which he found very charming. And he's just a charming man, very cultured, speaks seven languages. You know, his father was an ambassador to France and, you know, it just came from a very different background than mine. But we got along so well. And also, I think he felt that I wasn't intimidated by this project, you know, like a lot of people. And of course, I knew about Che, but I didn't know, I didn't know the nitty gritty. Mm. And so I wasn't like, you know, either deeply for or against him. Mm-hmm. And so I think that helped a lot for him. It was funny because he had announced to the industry that he was looking for a writer. So every agent in Hollywood sent him a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And so he had a stack of screenplays on his desk from ICM, William Morris, you name it. And he didn't want to read any of them. So he had his assistant read all the screenplays because he didn't want to. And he said afterwards, said to her, "Is there anything in that pile worth reading? Anything good in there?" And she says, "Yeah, this is one screenplay I really, really liked." And it was a screenplay I had written on spec called Lucky. And she just loved it. Mm-hmm. And so she, of all the screenplays, that's the one she passed on to Walter to read, and he liked it. So that's, on the basis of that, that's when he decided to have lunch with me.
Great, great luck again. And of course, having, you know, a strong spec that's out in the world, you know, having the, will get you these opportunities, if the spec is strong enough, of course.
Yeah.
But I would like to ask, I think, related to that, about maybe the sort of psychic economy of your own investment in playwriting, in writing for TV, because I know you're back to TV now with 100 Years of Solitude, though a very different form of TV than the network sitcom, and, you know, you've written for film for such a long time. And, you know, especially because your playwriting seems to, you know, generally be coming from your own impetus, and so much of your film is, you know, you are working on projects that other people have initiated. I'd just love to hear about your own attachments to your different types of work that you do.
The one-line answer, it's not very romantic, is that I write movies for money and I write plays for love. I don't need to be paid to write a play. In fact, you can't stop me from writing a play. I'm always writing a play. And so that's just a natural impulse on my part. And if, you know, if I didn't have to make a living, I wouldn't write films. Just wouldn't. But somewhere along the line, around the time of the Motorcycle Diaries, which was 2005, I started really falling in love with the craft of writing screenplays. Mm-hmm. And I became a real student of screenplays and movies. You know, so I would like watch Casablanca time and time again to like, how did they do that? You know, or The Godfather. And I think I became a better writer of screenplays when I started to respect the form more. You know, because I had grown up in the 70s, like, with really schlocky movies, mm-hmm. you know, like Towering Inferno and, you know, all that junk. And I just didn't know, you know. Then I took a film history class and was like, oh, my God, there's this filmmaker named Renoir and this film in Méliès and, you know, Orson Welles. And I'd never heard of these people. And I didn't understand that film was an art form until then, mm-hmm. you know, until I was watching, you know, these great films. And I thought, oh, okay, I don't know if I can write at that level, but it's certainly something to aspire to. Mm-hmm. You know, and I became a much better screenwriter that way. And so, you know, generally I juggle the two. A lot of it comes down to like, okay, what's my bank book look like today? You know, I've been lucky in the sense that the screen work comes to me. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go, you know, hustle like I used to. I used to do that a lot, but not anymore. And so I'll get offers or things will come in. And I generally say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. If it has any kind of interesting hook to it. So, you know, I wrote a film about Greenpeace, and I wrote a play about Cesar Millan. Do you know him? The Dog Whisperer? Mm-hmm. Wrote a play about him, a screenplay about him. So, you know, if the subject is that semi-interesting, I usually, and if I don't know much about it, I'll say yes. Because mm-hmm. I'm curious. I want to know. One of my heroes in the screenwriting world is Rod Serling. And Rod had a problem, apparently, with not being able to say no. And he would take on too many projects and not be good at them. So I you know, have fallen in that pattern sometimes where, not so much anymore, but at a certain time, I was just taking on too much, and I wasn't good at any of them.
Part of the way that you even talk about your playwriting and your screenwriting, too, also, I think, reflects a very different approach to the craft of them as well, right? You know, talking about screenwriting as something that you do for hire, something that is a job, you know, you're a worker, a professional with words, I think in some ways reflects all of the genre expectations, right? All of the ways that screenplays are following the form and playing with the form, but also we know what a screenplay looks like and what the expectations of screenplays are. Whereas your plays, I mean, many people describe your plays as being rule-breaking, but there is a different way that you seem to be playing with expectations there. And I'd love to hear just more about your approach to the craft of your media.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I guess if I have a formula for plays or a rule, it would be form follows function. And so, you know, when I teach playwriting, I teach this idea that there are no genres in theater, but there are a million genres in theater, meaning Pinter is a genre, Chekhov is a genre, Carol Churchill is a genre, and they have created a form unique to their voices, and that's what that is. You young writer, you don't have a genre yet. You're just starting out. But strive to create that, to be your own genre. And so that's what I've tried to do. And it's funny because my genre, if I have a genre, is no genre, meaning every single play is different from the previous play. And Carol Churchill writes that way. Like, you read two of her plays, you go, this can't be written by the same person. And I kind of love that. And so I like to, like, you know, establish rules in one play and break those same rules in the next play. You know, write a tight, you know, kitchen sink drama and then write something completely bonkers, you know. And that's fun because, you know, as I said earlier, I don't do it for money. The money in theater is not very good. and so what I get out of it is the satisfaction of the artistry of it. And that's really where, that's the treasure of writing theater. You know, for film, the film world likes to pigeonhole writers, put you in a category. Oh wait, you're the rom-com writer. You're the historical drama writer. You know, you're the mystery writer.
You do magical realism.
Yeah, I do magic realism, yeah. But I have fallen into a bit of a, not a rut, but a kind of category, which is I'm the, I can adapt novels very well. And so 100 Years of Solitude, On the Road, which some people would say is not very well done. but, you know, I adapted this novel called American Rust into a film. And so, oh, and I did, even though a movie never got made, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde into a film, which would have been a great film. But I can't get into the horror story of it, but it did not go anywhere. But that's sort of like, I guess if I have a lane in this business, is that I'm good at adapting literature. And that, you know, and there's some great books I really want to adapt. And I can't read a novel without thinking of the movie, unfortunately. I just read this incredible novel by a Norwegian writer called Septology, which is 600 pages long and is like gorgeous. And I kept thinking, oh man, please let me make this into a movie.
That is, yeah, that's quite an occupational hazard to always have the images running through your head in a very cinematic way.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, is this a close-up or is this a two-shot? Or
where's the first act end?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
But you've also done adaptation in theater, right? You've Sueño adapts the Pedro Calderón de la Barca, Life is a Dream. What's your approach to adapting in theater?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I try to do is pretend, like when I was working on the Calderón piece, I tried to pretend that I was Calderón living right now. And if I were to write Life is a Dream, How Would I Do It mm-hmm. today? You know, so with that, I changed certain things. Like the original play is set in a sort of vague Dark Ages, mm-hmm. the Middle Ages of Europe, and it's set in Poland, mm-hmm. a kind of fictional Poland. And I thought, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to set the play in the year it was written. Mm-hmm. It was like 1621, I think. And I want to set it in Spain. Mm-hmm. And so the king, who is in the original, the Polish king, is now the king of Spain, mm-hmm. dealing with colonizing a new world. Mm-hmm. And what is that all about? Mm-hmm. So those changes were really fun to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kept Calderón's plot. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not good at plot, I have to say. But what I did change were the nature of his language and his metaphors. Mm-hmm. So the metaphors, you know, for instance, the character of Segismundo is trapped in a tower and he's miserable. He's lived there all his life. And, you know, and the Calderón lines are beautiful descriptions of his misery and his yearning to be with people and God and everything. And I was thinking, what would be a good metaphor for that kind of misery? And so I wrote this line that could never have been written at the time. Mm-hmm. It's completely anachronistic. And he says, I am the soul of polio and anthrax. Mm. And that's how he described his misery. Mm. And so, you know, so you have this, you know, 17th century character saying that, mm-hmm. and it's like weird, you know, but theatrical. And so to me that, you know, I look for the ways in which I can theatricalize this classic, mm. you know. I wrote, one of my very first adaptations was, I don't know if you know the play, The Dybbuk.
You know,
great classic of the Yiddish theater, mm-hmm. which I love that play. So I took that play and put it in a Puerto Rican ghetto, mm-hmm. you know, and basically the same story, mm-hmm. you know. So that kind of stuff, I find it a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've mentioned working with, I mean, obviously Life is a Dream is, you know, a classic of the golden age of Spanish drama. You know, The Dybbuk is a classic in its own right, of course. 100 Years of Solitude is incredibly, incredibly culturally important. You know, people have very strong attachments to Che Guevara. People have very strong attachments to On the Road. So having worked with such sort of momentous material, I'd like to ask you about the sort of sense of responsibility around that. And I think in two ways. The first is just that I can't imagine any writer not being nervous tackling such, you know, again, such momentous things. But also just in terms of your responsibility to the material, to the people who actually, you know, to the cultural heritage, sort of what you imagine your own role being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, I think, you know, I take the responsibility very seriously. You know, I once was asked to adapt a Blood Wedding into a Broadway musical,
okay,
which is fishy at best. And then I heard that the producer wanted to hire Ricky Martin and J-Lo as the leads. And I thought to myself, I just don't want to be the guy that ruined, you know, Blood Wedding for a generation. Mm-hmm. I will not be that. So I quit the project. I didn't do that. That's one I didn't do. But for these, yeah, I mean, I, you know, you got to love the material. So I loved, you know, On the Road and 100 Years of Solitude and Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, those mm-hmm. things that I adapted. And, you know, I think starting from that love that is love but not worship, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. if you worship it, then you're dead. Mm-hmm. If you're intimidated by the meaning of what you're doing, you're dead. You know, I had to take the enormous cultural importance of each work and just put it aside and said, I'm not dealing with that. I'm dealing with mundane day-to-day problems of adaptation. Mm-hmm. And how do I get from point A to point B in this story? and to do it with some originality. And so to me, I really had to divorce myself from what it was that I was really doing, mm-hmm. you know, which was tinkering with classics and masterpieces. You know, I had to stop thinking about it. And I would have been paralyzed mm-hmm. if I really took in the enormity of adapting the Motorcycle Diaries. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. When I was hired, people warned me to get an unlisted phone number because the conservatives in Miami were going to kill me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which didn't happen. But if I had really taken that seriously, I don't know if I could have continued, you know?
Well, it's at very least an incredibly impressive capacity for compartmentalization, which is very good. But also, I mean, you studied under Garcia Marquez at Sundance, too. Was his voice not in your head as you tried to...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he did say to us, point blank, he said, I wrote this book so it can never be done on film. Mm. And he was very proud of that. Mm-hmm. And when you read the book, you go, yeah, he did. Uh-huh. He accomplished that. But I don't think even he had imagined, you know, a television series for mm-hmm. that book, mm-hmm. a limited series, 16 episodes. You know, so when you break it down into 16 one-hour episodes, you can do that book.
And you wrote all of the episodes for that.
Yes, I wrote, I was the first writer to tackle it. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote 16 one-hour episodes mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of like turned that massive novel into television. Mm-hmm. But when production happened, I wasn't in Columbia. So mm-hmm. all that happened down there. And there were, I think it's three writers mm-hmm. who then took my scripts and like tinkered with them. Made some cuts, rearranged some scenes, mostly for budgetary reasons. Mm-hmm. And so when you see it, you go, oh, yeah, that's my work, but it's also the work of other people.
Mm-hmm. But not a traditional writer's room where you were all writing together.
Yeah, I wasn't part of it.
Okay.
I think they were,
okay.
you know, because I, you know, when I was working on the script, on the series by myself, it was mostly during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so no writer's room existed at the time. Mm-hmm. So after that happened, the writers came together in Columbia, but they were there for production.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't like they were not inventing the wheel.
Right. So, if, you know, you need a rewrite, you need to bring scenes together, you need to sort of adjust things. They're the writers on the scene.
Yes, okay. Yes. And they did a good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very, very, very skillful.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, 100 Years is an extremely political book, and you've worked with a lot of very political material. As I was watching Erie, Indiana, it occurred to me that some of those are also quite political episodes, yeah. despite being a kid's show. There's an episode about a school nurse who has the support of the administration to sort of zombify the students with hypnosis so that they can have higher test scores,
yeah.
which I know this is still a decade before No Child Left Behind, but seems pretty on the pulse.
And that was a metaphor for Scientology.
For Scientology, I see, okay. There's also an episode with a sort of fantastical Bureau of Lost Items that I really like, which is a sort of scheme for planned obsolescence so that people will buy things to keep the economy going, which again, in the early 90s feels... Yeah.
There were buses taking people to the mall,
yes.
if you remember that. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. And then, of course, in your plays, you're approaching politics again from a very different angle, right? I think... references to Salvador Dali Make Me Hot, which is a wonderful title, by the way, the time period is tagged as shortly after the first Persian Gulf War, and the play, through an interpersonal relationship, processes the sort of effects of war on a family. Mm-hmm. But it's also a play with a talking cat and coyote and a sort of Lorca-esque animate moon who's a bit of a lech. Big time. Yeah, I just love to hear your thoughts about the way that politics in your work.
Yeah. We'll go back to Erie for just a second, because I wrote an episode that was so political and never got on the air. And that was about a kid who's kind of a rebel, mm-hmm. and he listened to this hardcore metal band called Pitbull Surfers, and But he also had a very abusive father. So the father was always yelling at him, like, you're a loser, you're a punk, I can't believe you're my son. Over and over again, the kid was just like, and so the kid ends up stealing a car, and the cops take the kid to the house, and the father says, see, it's the rock and roll. It's the rock and roll that made him do that. If you play the songs backwards, you hear the satanic messages. And he says, look, I'll show you. He puts a record on the thing, and he plays, spins it backwards, and what you hear out of the speakers is the father's voice abusing the son. You're a loser, you're a jerk. And that's how the episode ends. Well, it was too much for the head of NBC. He literally said to me, he says, as long as I'm the head of this network, that episode will never go on the air. It was shot. They spent a lot of money.
Really?
Yeah, wow. It was shot. It was quite good. But I think it was just too political for that. I mean, I think politics is required of a writer, you know? If you're conscious, if you have half a pulse, you know, and you think about what's happening and you're worried about the people in your lives and the larger community, you can't help it, you know, and I can't help it. And so, you know, we're entering a new political era, and I, you know, so interesting to see what happens in the arts, you know, in film and TV, because, you know, what could happen is that everyone just bows and rolls over and plays dead, and I'm not going to make waves. Yeah, that can happen. I hope that doesn't happen. I hope there's still enough rebellious spirit in the arts, you know. But I'm not that confident. I mean, I'm just not. So we'll see. But I think, I mean, you know, the Persian Gulf War had a big impact on my family. My brother, two of my brothers were there. One was in a tank and fought in the largest tank battle since World War II. In the desert, and my other brother was what they call a forward observer, and so I took that very personally. I took that war very personally. I was very against it, and you know, and wanted to explore the idea of what happens when the war comes home, what happens in the bedroom, you know, and what happens in this couple, and so that was to me the reason to write the play.
And, you know, speaking of this, how are the arts going to react to the upcoming political scene where we're recording this on January 21st, we should say? You are in two such very different industries, right? And in part because film costs so much money and makes so much money and is run by many people who are exclusively interested in making money, which you do not necessarily go into theater if making money is your primary goal. So I wonder if you just have thoughts about what you expect to see coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's going to have choices to make, and people, even the people who have huge financial interest in film, will have choices to make. And it's all going to depend on what those choices are. I will have to respond to the marketplace as it happens. And, you know, I am in my late 60s, so I could retire. And I have thought of that. I said, you know what, if it's just too crazy, it becomes something I can't believe in anymore, I'll just retire from film and just write my plays. But it's very concerning. You know, I mean, I came of age in the 60s and very inspired by, like, the life of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and all that stuff. And, you know, really wanted to be an artist because of them in a lot of ways. And I don't know where a young person finds inspiration politically anymore, at least to be an artist. I think people find inspiration to, like, do lots of other stuff.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned retirement, so I'm going to ask a question about sort of retrospection, which is, you know, you've built up such a huge body of work over your career. So if you imagine, you know, someday, many years down the line, when people are looking back at your body of work, are there particular things that you would most want to be remembered or you would most want people to take, you know, thematically or in terms of your commitments?
Yeah. I mean, I am very proud of some of the plays I wrote. You know, references to Salvador Dali is one, Marisol, Sueño, Cloud Tectonics, you know, Sonnets for an Old Century. You know, these are plays that, you know, I just poured my heart and soul into them, and I want to be remembered for them. You know, fortunately, they are taught in schools, so something is staying alive. Somebody once asked Tony Kushner, you know, what his definition of fame was, and he says, when they produce your plays in college. You know, so I dig that definition a lot. Yeah. In terms of film, I mean, I think, you know, my record is spotty, I think. I fully 90% of what I wrote never got made. So how do I judge that? You know, how does anyone judge that? It's just paper at this point. The films that I have had made, you know, I'm very proud of The Motorcycle Diaries. You know, I think On the Road is a very imperfect film for many reasons. You know, I had written and then was fired from a film called Letters to Juliet, which, you know, take it or leave it. So, you know, I don't have, until 100 Years of Solitude, a body of anything that I felt super, super proud of. Like, that's something I'm proud of, you know, and I am proud of Erie, Indiana. And so, you know, it's sort of like, if you ignore the ones that were written and never made, then, you know, I have a very patchy past.
So we're here at DePaul University, and I know that you have taught a good number of times, and you've been working with students here, and I teach screenwriting here, and I'd be interested if you have sort of pieces of advice that come to mind first for young playwrights, for young screenwriters, for young writers, things that you think are most important to know when you're at the beginning of your journey.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things to know is that it's a long journey. I tell students it's a lifetime apprenticeship. You will never know it all. No one will ever know it all. If you're not constantly learning, then something's wrong, you know? And be prepared for that. Be prepared to not know what you're doing for a long time and to slowly accumulate skill. I'm just going to take talent as a given with students. I always do, but it's the level of skill and craft that will improve with time, and it will get better. You know, I used to write endless drafts of my plays because I didn't know what I was doing, and now I can write a play in two drafts, and it'll be solid. Like, I don't waste time like that anymore. You know, both fields are dependent on relationships. On the kind of relationships you have with people. Keep those relationships, you know, pure and honest. Don't steal from your friends. Don't stab people in the back. Remember that people will talk about you and you want them to say only good things. And that's about your craft as a writer, but you as a person. That, oh yeah, that person, you know, he'll keep his word. If he says he's going to do something, he'll do it. You know, it's really, really important that that follow you wherever you go. That good reputation is part of it's on your resume. You know, in a way, patience. I always preach about patience. That impatience and exhaustion are two of your biggest enemies. Not bad agents. Not, you know, whatever. It's just your own. Making up deadlines that are artificial, like, oh, I've got to get a play on Broadway by the time I'm 30, or I've got to publish a novel or whatever. You know, I just think those things are deadly and counterproductive. You know, so I always preach patience. This is going to sound odd, but it's really important who your partner is. If you have a partner that doesn't support you 100% in your work, and then it's very difficult to get anything done. You always fighting them and yourself, and not that you have to have a doormat for a partner, that's not fun either, but, you know, somebody who, you know, celebrates what you're doing, you know, and knows that it's valuable, isn't going to nag you into, like, go into real estate and go to dentist school or something, you know. It's really, really important who you have at home, you know. Yeah, I think those are sort of the big ones, you know. Work hard, Know the field really well. Mm-hmm. Know the history of film if you're going into film. Mm-hmm. Know the history of theater if you're doing that. You know, I'm shocked sometimes to talk to students, young film screenwriters who don't know, mm-hmm. like they hadn't heard of, you know, they knew Casablanca, but, mm-hmm. you know, don't know much more. Mm-hmm. And hadn't seen The Third Man or, you know what you know, film noir is or, mm-hmm. you know, the French New Wave. Or the Czech New Wave. That's important to know that stuff. It's part of your history, and so can be so inspiring. If, you know, if you're going to watch the 400 Blows or you know whatever those movies are, and some of them are great. I think it's really important. Yeah, and in theater too. Know your Lorca. Know your Ibsen. Know your Chekhov. Know your Sam Shepard. You know that kind of stuff is really key. Mm-hmm.
Those are all really great pieces of advice.
Good.
Thank you so much, Jose Rivera, for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. That was a great interview.
Yeah, I really love, and especially the fact that he's worked in multiple forms of media, and especially the one that stood out to me was that he writes plays for free and movies for money. That says a lot.
Yeah, and I think that probably is going to resonate with a lot of people. That's a common challenge working in creative media industries, right? You know, that the projects that pay the rent and the projects that are passion projects are not necessarily the same things.
Well, and this, you know, speaking as we were in the first part of the podcast about the state of the media industries, this was one of those depressing topics that came up continually in my class, especially was the state of independent media and independent filmmakers who want to tell original stories or radical stories and the constriction within the industry about the ability to do that. And so, you know, that also kind of really throws into relief the challenges that any artist has today. So even if you want to do movies for money, that can also be difficult.
Yes, indeed. And as Rivera says, there are some hard choices to make.
Yes, everybody's going to have choices to make. He said that one stood out to me too.
Yeah.
And then one other thing I wanted to especially also, as we also reflected in the first part there on teaching, that idea of telling your students, know your field, know your history. I always love telling our media industry students, like if you want to work in the film industry, if you want to be a director, work in development, whatever it is, you got to know your film history. You know, you have to know what's come before you. And then it's also what everybody in the industry talks about, right? They love movies and TV. Certainly whatever things are on now are important, but you know, you want to be able to make references to past artworks. And so knowing your field, knowing your history, I think it's another really good lesson.
Not a bad one. Not a bad one at all. Speaking of knowing your history, this isn't reaching too terribly far back, but I have over the past several months been going back and watching some older TV series.
Oh, nice.
And honestly, because you know, I've got like this whole like pile of dystopian misery that, and I'm not talking about reality. I'm just talking about TV shows that I have queued up that I know I want to watch, but you know, I like the Scandinavian noir stuff and Severance I need to get back into and, you know, Last of Us, heartwarming tales about the power of the human spirit for sure. And I know I'm going to want to get back into those, you know, this summer when the sun is shining and, you know, hopefully there's a little bit more distance from everyday reality. But I have to say that one of the things that's been really good for my mental health during the semester has been rewatching Northern Exposure.
Oh, nice.
Which is, you know, I wrote my undergraduate thesis on it. Apologies to Jane Shattuck, who had to read a lot of mess about that so many years ago. But much of it ages really, really well. And mostly because it's like kind of a community of oddballs that are mostly kind to one another. And it's sort of refreshing and nice. Yeah. And it's also very episodic. There's a little, it has some seriality to it, but it's pretty self-contained. So it's pretty easy to dip in and out.
Yeah. And I can see that being a show that holds up well culturally, especially, you know, a show that's kind of about its own unique little world rather than trying to capture something realistic about that world in the moment is something that can hold up.
Yeah. And it's definitely ambitious. It's ambitious aesthetically in terms of its storytelling and sometimes visual techniques. But it's also fairly ambitious culturally. You know, it's dealing with race and ethnicity and gender in interesting ways. I think some of it is, like, I was kind of worried that it would be a little cringy with the way that it deals with particularly the Native American culture. And sometimes it's a little quaint, but I think especially for its time, it's really trying to build a different kind of story world. And I think that's kind of nice to see.
That's great.
It's not perfect, but definitely interesting.
All right. So there's our viewing recommendation for this episode.
That's mine. I don't know if you have anything.
What streamer is it on?
It's on Amazon.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And it had not been released for a very long time. I think it's one of those shows that probably got held up on music rights, but it's there. And the music is actually, the soundtrack stuff. I mean, the score is good too, but the commercial music that's in episodes is often really, really great.
I'm watching all current stuff right now, and of course one of them being The Studio, right? A satire about the state of the industry.
All right.
But I found even more trenchant industry satire in The Rehearsal. So the second season of Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal has just started, and the second episode in particular has a brilliant takedown of Paramount Plus. So I don't want to spoil anything about it, because, you know, if you've watched any of The Rehearsal, you never know what turn it's going to take. And so I don't want to spoil any of the turns, but especially anyone out there who studies media industries, second episode, you got to watch the first episode, but the second episode has a brilliant little bit.
Okay. Good. I will put that in the queue as well.
Right.
All right. None of this would be possible without the help of SCMS and the University of Notre Dame.
And then we want to thank some individual people as well. So thank you to Jordan Scholl, who interviewed Jose Rivera. So thank you to both of those folks. And then also thank you to Jonathan Nichols-Pethick for helping to coordinate that. He is at DePauw University, along with Jordan Scholl.
That was a nicely produced interview as well. So it's,
yeah.
Appreciate the work on that.
Yeah, definitely. And the golden ears of Todd Thompson will be really very grateful for that too.
Yes, they will.
And so Todd provides our mixing and music. He's at University of Texas at Austin. And then we're also ably assisted by David Lipson at University of Strasbourg, Stephanie Brown at Washington College, and Frank Mondelli at University of Delaware.
That's the crew. We all appreciate you listening to us. Thanks so much.